the Des Moines Register for Monday, February 12. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of Iowans with a print disability. My name is Twyla Glenn, and my partner at the microphone for the next 90 minutes is Nicole Tam. For the first hour, we'll cover local and national news from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Our second hour starts with birthdays and obituaries, followed by opinions, sports, and lifestyle news. We'll wrap up our broadcast with Dear Abby. Support for today's reading comes from the Des Moines Register and donations from individuals and listeners like you. Learn how you can keep the volunteer Voices of IRIS going strong at iowaradioreading.org. Now let's take a look at the weather and headlines from today's Des Moines Register. According to AccuWeather across the state, we should look for partly sunny skies and mild temperatures today. Winds northwest 6 to 12 miles per hour. Tuesday, times of clouds and wind and sun with the winds south 4 to 8 miles per hour. And the forecast for the next few days in central Iowa looks like this. On today and tonight, look for partly sunny skies and mild temperatures. Winds northwest 6 to 12 miles per hour. Increasing cloudiness Monday night with winds northwest 4 to 8 miles per hour. A high today of 48 and a low of 29. On Tuesday, mild with clouds and sun. High of 46 and a low of 30. On Wednesday, we'll be turning cloudy and mild with a high of 51 and a low of 33. On Thursday, a high of 44 and a low of 22 and partly sunny skies. Looking at precipitation in the 24 hours ending 4 p.m. Saturday, we've had zero precipitation. The month to date, a trace, with a normal month to date, 42 hundredths of an inch. The year to date normal would be 150, but we've actually had 1.91 inches. Last year to date, we'd had 1.82 inches of precipitation. Snowfall in the 24 hours through 4 p.m. Saturday was zero. The month to date also zero. Our normal month to date is 4 inches. The season to date has been 30 inches, and the normal season to date would have been 24.5 inches. Sunrise today was at 7:15 a.m. Sunset tonight, 5:44 p.m. Moonrise today, 8:56 a.m. Moonset today, 9:27 p.m. Turning now to the front page of the front page section of the Des Moines Register, the lead article is the second in a series entitled Effort Afoot to Attract More Insurance Measures. The other front page articles include more kids missing routine vaccines and a new president takes over at the Iowa Speedway. Now here with our first story is Nicole.
And we'll start with that insurance story that Twyla mentioned, the effort afoot to attract more insurance majors, where industries and universities are teaming up to fill the pipeline. This is from Tyler Jett of the Des Moines Register. This begins with the giant image up in the top of this piece, where there's a man talking in front of a group about insurance. This is actually a second story in a series, and it begins now. Jim Lewis wants kids these days to know that insurance is exciting. A former marketing executive, Lewis has became the director of the University of Iowa's Vong Institute of Risk Management and Insurance last fall. His arrival comes as insurance leaders around Des Moines hope the state's universities and colleges can pump out more talent. Executives of the Des Moines Metro's insurance industry, centered in a slow-growth state, know the competition for each crop of graduating students is fierce. They want more candidates, and that means that they want more students to think about insurance early in their college careers. Lewis admits that his task is tough. Business majors usually dream about making money in other fields. They watch Wall Street and imagine a career in Manhattan, or Silicon Valley and dream of California. Or the more subtly named industry, the British drama about the investment banking industry. Showrunners aren't pitching more prestige dramas about the lives of underwriters and actuaries. Lewis says that we've got to do something pretty dynamic and aggressive as an industry to fill this pipeline. It may not seem too dramatic, or dynamic rather, but Lewis added that his first approach is important. In mid-January, as the spring semester in Iowa City began, he visited the early finance courses. He explained why students need to consider the risk management and insurance major, a program the university rebooted 40 years after a cost-cutting dean axed it. Lewis says the major returned last fall because insurance executives have lobbied for more young employees. The initiative comes as other Iowa universities are trying to bulk up their insurance programs. The Iowa Economic Development Authority has also partnered with colleges and companies to create an insurance internship program that's aimed at freshmen and sophomores. The schools are responding to a problem with the state's labor force. After decades of employment growth far exceeding the national average, the Des Moines Metro has shed about 4% of its financial activities jobs since July of 2017. This comes as the country overall has increased financial activities jobs by 9%. While much of Des Moines' jobs loss occurred because Wells Fargo and Company has scaled back its mortgage division, the metro's insurance industry is not growing as fast as it once was. Rather than leading the country, Des Moines has been adding insurance jobs over the past 6 years at about the same pace as the country overall. Des Moines has fallen well behind insurance job growth in faster-growing cities like Phoenix, Atlanta, and Orlando. The problem has led to a debate among local corporate leaders. Does Des Moines need to recruit more companies that can grow jobs, or does the state need to prepare more employees whose availability can encourage companies to expand here? Lewis believes the latter is the right answer. He says that's what the industry is asking us to do, bring them more talent. As an academic offering, risk management is about learning how to evaluate a company's vulnerabilities. Professors will teach students how to identify areas where companies are at risk, what risks are most dramatic, and what managers can do in response. The major can help students prepare for any industry, Lewis said, but it is particularly helpful in insurance, where employees must put a price on a contract years before they know what the contract will cost them. Typically, professors told the Des Moines Register, insurance companies do not need college graduates who studied their industry. Instead, companies look for students who studied business management, human resources, marketing, accounting, law, software development, data analytics, or actuarial science. But they said courses in risk management could better prepare students for life in the industry. Lewis says many of the 167 students majoring in risk management at the University of Iowa are also pursuing other majors. Kevin Croft, the director of the Kelly Center for Insurance Innovation at Drake University, said of the University of Iowa's program, he says that you're a much more attractive employee. I don't think I have to train you up on that much. Risk management has a long history at the University of Iowa, spearheaded by Emmett Vaughn, an early pioneer in the school in 1963. His textbooks were used around the world, and the United Nations tapped Vaughn to assess the values of damages in Kuwait after the Gulf War. Former Governor Terry Branstad credited Vaughn's teachings for giving the state some of the best regulators in the country, building Iowa's reputation as an insurance hub. Terry Vaughn, a former Iowa insurance commissioner, says he was an incredible teacher. He took complicated concepts. He made them simple. He made them entertaining to learn. He had lots of stories and lots of examples that would embed lots of concepts in your brain. People loved going to his classes. But in 1983, the university ended the risk management major, moving Vaughn to an associate dean role. Branstad said the state's universities were cutting majors to save costs as the budget shrank during the farm crisis. The business school's dean at the time, George Daly, told the Des Moines Register that he couldn't recall Iowa having an insurance major, but he wasn't surprised to hear that he would have cut it. He says that you kind of get these specialized majors, and then often they have enrollment problems, and so streamlining the curriculum, as it would be stated, would be a quite reasonable objective. At Drake, Croft says the university also cut its risk management major in the early 1990s because of an interest of students issue. Not everyone saw the cuts the same way. Dana Ramit, a 1974 risk management graduate, says it was a egregious act, she says. Ramit, who founded the Dana Company, a Des Moines insurance agency, says that Iowa has lost ground to other states in recruiting insurance talent because it lost a risk management major. He says that he got nine job offers. Oh, sorry, Dana is a man. I'm sorry. He says that he got nine job offers out of college, which he then attributed to Vaughn's status as a, quote, an icon. Ramit remained close to Vaughn after graduation and also advocated for the university to bring in the major back for years, Finally, in 2005, a year after Vaughn's death, the school launched the Vaughn Institute. Remt says that the university administrators declined to restart the major, though. He says other deans and professors may have objected to spending more money on new staff and classes. Instead, the program offered a certificate for students who took 5 courses. But Ram says that he and other executives did continue to advocate for a major. Amy Christoph Brown, who also became the Tipped College of Business Dean in 2020, pushed the request through the Board of Regents 2 years ago. Ram says that it's just been one of the most rewarding experiences I've ever had, and seeing this thing come back to life. Other schools around the state are also trying to improve the talent pipeline. At Drake, Croft says the school hosts Disruption Days, when students listen to guest speakers and share how they're trying to change the insurance industry. Croft hopes that these talks excite students who might view insurance as a sad industry. Drake also hosts what's called an Innovation Lab, where executives from EMC Insurance Companies, Principal Financial Group, and also Holmes Murphy & Associates share the issues they're trying to solve. Holmes Murphy CEO Dan Kuge says that the company received feedback from students last summer about launching a managing general agent line of business and how a startup could lower risk for car wash companies. In Ames, Iowa State University added actual science majors in 2019. Professor Ruhal Parsa, who joined the faculty from Drake, says the principal and CEO Dan Houston and other Des Moines executives told him the state needed more actuaries. He says that local companies have struggled to land graduating students, particularly from a school like Drake, where many of these students come from Chicago. He says the young kids, they want to go somewhere fun. They don't think Des Moines is fun. It's boring. There's nothing to do here. He added that many Iowa State students come from rural parts of the state, and he believes they are more likely to stay in this area after school. About 35 students are majoring in actual science. Parsa does hope to bump that number up to 50. For them, Des Moines is big, he said. They're happy, and that is why business like our program. Or businesses, rather, like their program. All the schools are participating in Insure Your Future, the internship program that the IEDA launched last year. The program pairs freshmen and sophomores with companies, giving them paid internships in hopes that they will become interested in this insurance field. Terry Vaughn says that program is the brainchild of Michael Gold, that's the state's Insurance Economic Development Director. The IEDA did not return the registrar's interview request. Lewis says that about 70 students at schools around the state interned with about 25 companies last summer, the first cohort of Insure Your Future. F&G CEO Christopher Blunt says that he understands why more young students aren't gravitating towards the industry. He says it doesn't jump to the top of anyone's mind of sexy industries. Blunt himself wasn't interested in insurance when he studied at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. He started as an asset manager. He says that the insurance could reach more students if it marketed itself better. He said that executives need to explain the impact they can have, that the contracts they sell will pay to rebuild homes after storms, or help families if a breadwinner dies unexpectedly. He says that too many insurance leaders are, quote, math nerds who talk about the mechanics of their insurance contracts. He says that we have to talk about what we do, the outcomes, the mission. Over in Iowa City, Lewis says that he also believes the industry can achieve that goal. In particular, he thinks that students need to know that they can earn a solid living without spending long hours in a hyper-competitive atmosphere. He said current finance majors are gearing up for a hard path on Wall Street. He says a lot of them that hit reality when they come out of those jobs, what have I done to myself? It's a really tough survival.
More kids are missing routine vaccines. More school-age children in Polk County and across Iowa receive what are called religious exemptions to required immunizations last year, marking another increase in a trend that has concerned public health officials since the coronavirus pandemic. Slow increase in exemptions also comes as childhood immunization rates continue to decline across the state, which some experts say is directly caused by vaccine misinformation that was rampant during the coronavirus pandemic. Hesitancy surrounding new COVID-19 shots has spread to other shots, including routine childhood vaccines, leading to more young Iowans skipping vaccinations that offer key protection to serious disease. We've seen a rampant spread of misinformation, and some parents and caregivers can be vulnerable to that because of the backlash against COVID vaccines, said Elizabeth Faber, executive director of the Iowa Immunizes Coalition. In 2023, more than 2,400 students in school districts across Polk County received a religious exemption to school vaccination requirements, according to the County Health Department's annual school audit report. That group makes up about 3% of student enrollment in Polk County. That's nearly a 28% increase in religious exemptions from the year before, when 1,900 students had a religious exemption. Families may opt out of school vaccination requirements if immunization, quote, conflicts with a genuine and sincere religious belief, end quote. Iowa law notes that the belief must be religious, not based on a moral or a personal objection to vaccines. However, parents do not have to cite a specific religious belief to obtain a religious waiver. For us at the health department, this is cause for concern. We're worried that we're seeing this number trending upward, said Madison Van Gundy, public health communication officer at the Polk County Health Department. However, as a whole, Polk County is doing fairly well in terms of vaccination rates, so right now we don't want to ring the alarm bells, but we are worried about religious exemptions increasing, so it is something that we're going to continue to keep an eye on, Van Gundy said. The vast majority of students at Polk County Public School Districts are fully vaccinated, according to the County Health Department report. The lowest rate is seen among non-public students, with about 90% of those school-aged children fully vaccinated in 2023. Polk County Health Department's report notes that the number of students who are not fully vaccinated has been increasing since 2020. The percentage of students without a full panel of shots rose from about 3% in 2020 to nearly 6% in 2023. In all, more than 4,938 students did not have all of their school-required immunizations in 2023, a nearly 18% increase from the year before. Polk County reflects a similar trend seen statewide, according to 2023 immunization rates recently released by the Iowa Department of Health and Human Services. 3% of the more than 524,000 students enrolled in Iowa schools for the 2023-24 school year have a religious exemption to vaccines, about 16,000 total students. That's an increase from the 2.6% in the previous school year and 2.3% in the 2021-22 school year. In all, 6.4% of students attending Iowa schools are under-immunized or are not immunized, an increase from the 5.8% the previous school year, according to the HHS report. In 2023, 69.7% of Iowa's two-year-olds had received all doses of recommended vaccines. Since 2020, Iowa has seen a slight decline in the uptake of the full panel of recommended immunizations for children by the time they reach age two, which includes shots to protect them against polio, measles, meningitis, and many other diseases. Vaccination rates among that age group was about 76% in 2020. Vaccine uptake fell to about 73% in 2021 and to 70% in 2022. Typically, public health officials believe 90% immunization rate is necessary to prevent the spread of disease, Faber said. We're still finding hesitancy with certain vaccines, Faber said. Anecdotally, some of our providers are saying that they don't have as many patients requesting flu shots or things like that as they did in the past. Some of that hesitancy may have spilled over a little bit into other vaccines, Faber said. Public health officials have said the pandemic upended routines for many families, meaning doctor's appointments to get those vaccines were delayed for some young Iowans. Though vaccine hesitancy is a factor for this age group, Faber said other barriers may be preventing some families from keeping up with a frequent vaccine schedule, such as a lack of transportation or shortage of nearby healthcare providers. She also said some families may still vaccinate their children, but are choosing to space out vaccine administration over a longer period of time. Still, immunization rates among Iowa's youngest population has improved since 2015, when just 62% of that age group was up to date on all recommended vaccines. In Polk County, about 73% of youth completed their two-year-old immunizations last year, the same rate as 2022. That did drop from nearly 76% in 2021 and 79% in 2020. Compliance with recommended vaccines for adolescents between the ages of 13 to 15 years old fared better among Iowans last year, state public health data shows. Overall, 88% of that population had received all of their recommended shots in 2023. That's a slight decrease from the 89% in 2022 and 2021. In 2020, immunization rates was 88%. About 94% of Polk County adolescents were fully vaccinated with those recommended shots in 2023. That's the same as 2022. Faber said it's often easier for families to stay up to date on recommended vaccine series for that age group since there's a less demanding dose schedule to follow for those shots. Public health officials with Iowa Immunizes are working to address vaccine hesitancy among Iowans with the goal of improving immunization rates among the state's youngest populations. Faber said primary care providers, who are often the most trusted sources of information for patients, are key to the effort. We're definitely working to reduce that misinformation, to make sure there's accurate information, and to make sure providers have the tools they need to share that accurate information in a trusting, caring manner, Faber said. They care about their patients. They care about the community. They're doing a great job, but we also have provider shortages. Van Gundy also encourages residents to seek out an annual vaccine against COVID-19 and influenza. We definitely want to encourage people to get those vaccines if they haven't done so yet, Van Gundy said. It's still a good time to get them. We tend to see respiratory viruses circulate in our community until summertime. So even though we're seeing a decrease in hospitalization rates for flu, COVID, and RSV right now, she says it's still a good idea to get those.
And the final story on the front page of the Des Moines Register, new president takes over at the Iowa Speedway. The first cup race is set for June. This is from Philip Jones of the Des Moines Register. With snow covering parts of the backstretch and wind whipping, Eric Peterson stood at the finish line at Iowa Speedway and envisioned cars hurtling by at more than 130 miles per hour during the track's first NASCAR Cup Series race in June. Peterson, a lifelong Kansan, was named the new president of the Iowa Speedway on Thursday. He steps into the role as the Speedway prepares to host the June 16 NASCAR event. Less than a month later, there will be a pair of NTT IndyCar Series races, marking one of the busiest periods in the track's 18-year history. The inaugural cup race, the Iowa Corn 350, will be the most important race in Iowa history, Peterson said. Former Iowa Speedway president David Hyatt left the job during the pandemic, according to NASCAR, which owns the Newton track about 40 miles east of Des Moines. The track had been without a president since then. Most recently, Peterson directed sales for NASCAR's West region and was based at Kansas Speedway in Kansas City, Kansas. Hyatt's longtime goal was to bring a cup race to Iowa, and now Peterson will be tasked with preparing for that soon-to-be-realized ambition. All of the tickets for the Iowa Corn 350 had been claimed before the scheduled sale date of December 4th, with fans placing $25 deposits in advance. On Wednesday, grandstand tickets were listed for as much as $604 on resale websites like StubHub. Peterson says of the track on Wednesday, showing that we have a sold-out race in a matter of minutes really does prove that there is an appetite for racing at Iowa Speedway. If you haven't been to a NASCAR race, it is an experience unlike any other in any sport of any entertainment. It is great watching it on television, but being there is such a visceral experience, he says. Iowa Speedway will be one of the just three tracks in 2024 to host both Cup and NTT IndyCar races, the two top series in the nation. Worldwide Technology Raceway near St. Louis and Indianapolis Motor Speedway will be the only other tracks to do that. Since it was built in 2006, Iowa Speedway has become a special track for race fans, Peterson said. At just 7/8 of a mile, it generates tight, tense action, yet its so-called tri-oval shape and a front stretch with 10 degrees of banking do allow for cars to hit higher speeds than at most short tracks. From 2009 to 2019, Iowa Speedway hosted 20 Xfinity Series and 13 Truck Series races. And since 2007, Iowa Speedway has hosted 19 IndyCar races. NASCAR bought that track in 2013 for $10 million. While the June 16 NASCAR Cup race is sold out, tickets are still available for the two races that precede that weekend. That's the ARCA Menard Series, an Iowa Level Feeder Circuit, on June 14th, and the Xfinity Series, a step below NASCAR, on June 15th, according to Peterson. Drivers in the Cup are also scheduled to practice on June 14th and qualify the following day. This is from Matt Humphrey, a communications manager for NASCAR. Entertainment is still being finalized, but the team is working to make it an event that fans won't soon forget, Peterson said. Outside the track on the midway, there will be fan zones, kid zones, and sponsor booths and activities, as well as souvenir trailers. Musical artists will also perform outside the track near turn number 4, he said. Peterson added that we're going to put on a show for folks that can bring out the entire family, so there's something to do for every person that comes out here. Over the years, the track has earned a reputation as a place drivers love, with opportunities to pass both in the corners and on the straightaways. But it has struggled at times to stay afloat, and just 3 years ago, many fans thought it might be closed for good. That crisis came in 2021 as the track fell off the IndyCar, Xfinity Series, and Truck Series schedules. ARCA raced there that year, but the only other major activity was crash testing of vehicles and farm equipment in the field. NASCAR then laid off most of its staff and leaned heavily on workers at Kansas Speedway to assist in those operations. But when IndyCar returned in 2022, with support from Hy-Vee, a major sponsor of the series, and it also featured race weekend concerts highlighted by high-wage profile performers, that includes country star Blake Shelton and his pop diva wife Gwen Stefani. Humphrey, the NASCAR spokesperson, says that the first time he came to the track, he thought it was primed for a cup date. Peterson echoed his sentiments. Humphrey says that you won't find a racetrack that has so much ready from an infrastructure standpoint. Look how nice the media center is, how nice the infield is, the garage area is top-notch. You also have the Newton Club, the place from a racetrack standpoint can handle a cup race. Most tracks on the Cup Series scheduled to hold at least 50,000 fans. Grandstand attendance at Iowa will be capped at about 25,000. But corporate support for the event is strong enough to warrant a cup date well into the future. The Iowa Corn Growers Association, the title sponsor of the Iowa Speedway's IndyCar event through 2018, will sponsor this cup race. Numerous other sponsorships for the weekend will also be announced in the next few months, according to Peterson. Several factors go into creating the schedule each year, he says. The opportunity for Iowa Speedway to host a cup race came from the closure of a previous series site, that's Auto Club Speedway in Fontana, California, because of remodeling. Iowa fans' enthusiasm showed NASCAR that it was right about the track's readiness to turn into a big game, Peterson says. He says the support was unlike anything I've ever seen for any cup race that's ever been announced. Hy-Vee's sponsorship of the IndyCar doubleheader at the Speedway does run through this year, and it now is in discussions with NASCAR to sponsor this year's Cup Series race weekend in some form as well. This is according to Tina Puthoff, the spokesperson for the supermarket chain. Details of the contract are not yet finalized, and no other information is yet available, Puthoff says. Hy-Vee has spent millions using IndyCar to reach new audiences in places like Indianapolis, one of several cities West Des Moines-based company is planning to expand to. It also is planning stores in Tennessee, long a NASCAR hotbed. Peterson says that he has bought a house in Ankeny and is excited about the summer ahead. He says it's going to be an incredible opportunity to show off Iowa.
And that wraps up the stories from the front page of the Register. We'll turn now to the Metro and Iowa section, and we'll start with the description of a photo display here entitled Perry's Shops Serve Up Sweet Treats. Perry's 21st Annual Chocolate Walk drew visitors for a self-guided tour of shops and a complimentary chocolate treat from each one. The Valentine's Day-themed event, with a ticket price of $10, is held each year on the second Saturday of February, so you might want to mark your calendars for next year. The photos show a couple of folks, Kay Luderman and Jody Luderman, picking up a brownie truffle bomb at Betsy Peterson Designs. And a smaller one shows 6-year-old Kalani Renner, also of Perry, picking out a brownie at Perry Flowers by Donna Jean during the chocolate walk. And the third picture in the photo display is a close-up of those brownie truffle bombs from Betsy Peterson Designs, and they look like a real chocolatey treat. So we'll start here with get ready. Daylight savings time is coming near. Most in the U.S. will spring forward, losing about an hour. It's time to spring forward once again. In March, millions of Americans will turn their clocks and lose an hour of sleep as daylight savings time begins. Here's what you need to know about when we spring forward and begin daylight savings time in 2024. First of all, when is daylight savings time coming this year? Daylight savings time will begin on Sunday, March 10, 2024 at 2 a.m. That's Sunday, March 10, so we're still got a couple of weeks before you lose that hour. That's local time. Whatever your time is, it's local time, when clocks will go ahead 1 hour. In 2024, daylight savings time will end for the year at 2 a.m. local time in November. It will pick up again next year on Sunday, March 9 in 2025. So what exactly is daylight savings time? Well, daylight savings time is the time between March and November when most Americans adjust their clocks by 1 hour. We lose an hour in March to accommodate for more daylight in the summer evenings. When we fall back in November, it's to add more daylight in the mornings. What states do not observe daylight savings time? Well, not all states and U.S. territories participate in daylight savings time. Hawaii and Arizona, with the exception of the Navajo Nation, do not observe daylight savings time, and neither do the territories of American Samoa, Guam, the Northern Marianas Islands, Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands. And you may wonder, wasn't daylight savings hour supposed to end? Well, the push to stop changing clocks was put before Congress in the last couple of years when the U.S. Senate unanimously approved what was called the Sunshine Protection Act in 2022, a bill that would make daylight savings time permanent. However, it did not pass, and it was not signed into law by President Joe Biden. A 2023 version of the act remained idle in Congress as well. Iowa lawmakers have considered similar bills in the past years, but have yet to pass that legislation.
And another story in the Metro and Iowa section, Dr. sues lawyers over Medicare settlement. This is from William Morris of the Des Moines Register. A prominent plastic surgeon who 2 years ago paid more than $800,000 to settle claims of an improper Medicare and Medicaid billing is now suing a number of his former attorneys, claiming that it was their bad advice that left him stuck with that bill. Dr. Ronald Bergman's lawsuit brings claims against Des Moines law firms Brown, Winnick, Graves, Gross, and also Bakersville, Schindler, Anderson, Goberlard, and Weiss, and also the Weinhardt Law Firm, as well as the Des Moines branch of Dorsey and Whitney, and also 5 individual attorneys at those firms. Bergman's suit accuses all of them of negligence and breach of contract in legal services that they provided him, and it also accuses one attorney of violating Bergman's privacy. Bergman claims that he was never advised to self-report that he alleged billing irregularities and that his attorneys failed to explore whether Mercy One Medical Center was legally responsible for those billings in question. A spokesperson for Mercy One, which is not named as a defendant, declined to comment. Bergman's current attorney, Mark Humphrey, declined to comment beyond the allegations in the complaint. Most of the attorneys and law firms that Bergman is suing did not respond to messages seeking for comment. Attorney Mark Weinhardt, who represents Bergman in the negotiating that $815,000 settlement, denied any negligence. Weinhardt says in a statement, "Our firm has a reputation for having a premier white-collar criminal and regulatory defense practice, and that reputation is built on the firm's zealous defense of all its clients. That includes Dr. Bergman and his medical practice. The firm stands behind its work that it did and the advice that it provided." Bergman's billing practices came under scrutiny following allegations by a former employee, Peggy West, in 2019. West, who worked 3 months as an office manager for Bergman's practice, filed a whistleblower suit alleging that he was overbilling the government in three ways: mislabeling minor medical services as more costly procedures, billing under his name for work done by trainee physicians who would have trainee received a lower rate, and also billing for services by a physician assistant who was not authorized to receive Medicare reimbursement. Western Court filings claimed that she encountered the issues while familiarizing herself with Bergman's records and brought them repeatedly to his attention. But she says that he told her he'd been billing that way for years, overruled her directions to other staff to correct the billings, and then made threatening comments, including that he knew people in the Mexican mafia. Bergman eventually settled that lawsuit in 2022 without admitting wrongdoing. West, as the one who brought that complaint, did receive $200,000 of the settlement. West separately sued Bergman for what she describes as pervasive sexual discrimination and harassment in his practice, one of three such lawsuits filed by female employees and physicians in 2020 and 2021. She later filed additional claims for retaliation and defamation after he accused her of stealing from him during her employment, resulting in criminal charges against her that were later dropped. West later dismissed that lawsuit. In his new court filing, Bergman says that he first learned about the possible billing issues in 2018 prior to West's hiring, and that he consulted several attorneys who told him that there was a small possibility that some of his billings could cause issues with Medicare. Bergman then turned to attorneys at Brown Winnick, a prominent local business law firm, and a subsequent audit in February of 2019 identified a myriad of internal issues. That includes billing mistakes and inadequate training of these responsible for billing. The complaint describes that the attorney's efforts to resolve these issues, but says that they had not done so by October 2019, when West filed her complaint. In particular, Bergman says that his attorneys never gave formal legal recommendation that he self-report the issues to federal officials. Had he done that, he alleges that he would have faced much lower potential damages. He also faults his various attorneys for failing to investigate whether Mercy One, which ran the plastic surgery fellowship in which procedures and questions took place, was legally responsible for the resulting billing, or whether the manufacturer of one of the medical products was to blame for alleged fraudulent billing that's related to its use. Bergman, who is 74 years old, also is enmeshed in a years-long dispute with the Iowa Board of Medicine about whether he remains fit to practice, and he accuses that his past attorneys of mishandling aspects of that matter as well. Among other alleged errors, he blames his legal team for failing to contest an order from the board that requires him to undergo a medical evaluation, and one attorney for providing medical records that he claims were inaccurate to medical facilities that subsequently denied him admitting privileges. Bergman, through Humphrey, has asked a district judge to reverse the board's order restricting his practice, and his appeal is currently pending.
The Des Moines Register's Hunter is honored with a Master Editor Publish Award. That would be Carol Hunter, the executive editor of the Des Moines Register. Growing up on an acreage in rural southeast Kansas, the daughter of wheat and soybean farmers, Carol Hunter regularly faced the vicissitudes of nature, disappointing yields, droughts, floods, parasites. Later, as a decades-long newspaper editor, she braved decidedly less physical obstacles, but ones with similarly strong headwinds. Sitting at the helm of the Des Moines Register for nearly a decade and in leadership positions for years prior, Hunter weathered a rapidly changing media landscape, one that traded newsprint over morning coffee for mobile page views grabbed on the go and digital engagement hunched over a screen. In both cases, Hunter relied on the same foundational tools, a relentless work ethic, dogged focus, and an optimistic metal, a faith, really, born from a life of lessons on the farm, namely, with steady hands and clear eyes, the sun will rise and the crops will come in. You can and will endure. For that innate stewardship and for her years of service to Iowa journalism, Hunter was honored as a Master Editor Publisher by the Iowa Newspaper Association at the organization's annual banquet Thursday night in Des Moines. The nod is considered a Lifetime Achievement Award. Quoting from the award, Hunter is intensely committed to upholding the very best in journalistic standards, is a dedicated mentor, and routinely pushes to increase transparency in journalism. It goes on, she demonstrates the very best attributes of journalism in Iowa and has unmatched dedication and loyalty to both her organization and her craft. Those who nominated Hunter for the award pointed to her reputation for finding resources for ambitious projects, including the Register's recent full-length Rag Bride documentary called Shift, and the renowned Des Moines Register political soapbox, which allows Iowans direct access to those running for the highest office in the land. Being able to lead many different projects and many in spotlights is no small feat, and it takes a journalist with skills at the highest level, the citation read. Despite a fervent devotion to journalism now, her first love was music, piano, and percussion, to be specific. But Hunter always enjoyed writing, too, and getting lost in words, so she decided to try her hand at the student newspaper at the University of Kansas, the fortuitous beginning of a career that crisscrossed both the country and newspaper sections. Her first professional role was at the Santa Fe New Mexican, where her attention to detail was quickly put to use, laying out front pages. Next, she moved to the Courier News in Bridgewater, New Jersey, where she met the love of her life, Tom Perry, who longtime Register readers will remember as one of the best feature writers to put ink to paper in the metro. After 16 years, the couple followed Hunter's promotion to editor at the Green Bay Press Gazette and decamped to Wisconsin. But a desire to be slightly closer to her family farm and her ailing parents brought Hunter west to Iowa in 2004. Her first role on the Register's masthead was as editor of the storied editorial page, which has garnered 4 Pulitzer Prizes for editorial writing and 3 for editorial cartooning in what will soon be 175 years of publication. She bounced from there to political editor and eventually news director before becoming executive editor in late 2016. Her tenure in the top job has been marked by more changes and more strong headwinds in the continually changing media landscape and deep personal losses, including the death of her husband. But the ever-steadfast Hunter has weathered those vicissitudes, as she always did, with a steady hand and clear eyes. I want to leave the Register strong and vital and sustaining Iowa journalism at the high level for eons, and this staff is going to help us get there and is already doing that work every day, Hunter said at a celebratory gathering after winning. You have to be an optimist anymore to be a journalist, and I am bullish on the future of the Des Moines Register and the future of journalism.
Now to a story that's an online exclusive. Why is there a construction crew at the Walnut Street Bridge here in Des Moines? This is from Addison Lathers of the Des Moines Register. Excavators on the riverbank, a blocked lane. What is going on the Walnut Street Bridge? So this is happening at East Walnut Street over the Des Moines River in downtown Des Moines. The 450-foot-long arch bridge, supported on concrete piers and abutments on timber piles, carries a lane of traffic in each direction, with 8-foot-wide sidewalks on both sides and 88 angled, back-in parking spaces. It is free to park there, and it is an amenity that is heavily used by downtown commuters. The bridge saw extensive work in 1966 to rehabilitate it, and minor repairs were complete in 1990. Based on recent inspections, it is considered in poor condition. Talks and repairs have been underway since 2016, and in August, the Des Moines City Council approved that reconstruction. The project is ahead of schedule and it could start in less than 2 weeks. Preparations started earlier this month because of the warmer weather. That is according to city spokesperson Devin Perry. Kramer & Associates, the winning bidder for this project, currently is grading along the river's east bank to accommodate its construction equipment. If the favorable weather continues, Perry said, the company plans to start reconstruction of that bridge the week of February 19th. Parking along the south side of the bridge already is closed off. Once the project officially begins, the rest of the bridge will be closed to traffic for the entirety of the project, and that is at least 2 years. The principal river walk on the west side of the river and the John Pat Dorian Trail on the east side will also be blocked. The Walnut Street Bridge will hopefully reopen by fall of 2026. It's going to cost $19.5 million. But why is this important? The city already spent millions revamping the Grand Avenue and Locust Street bridges, the other two of three bridges over the Des Moines River depicted on the city's flag, and also repairing the Court Avenue Bridge. So why is it controversial, on the other hand? Before reconstruction of the Walnut Street Bridge was approved, council members Josh Mandelbaum and Carl Voss argued that the traffic counts didn't justify a fourth bridge downtown, especially as the city entered a tight budget season. Mandelbaum suggested that the Walnut Street span could be converted into a pedestrian-only bridge or a park, which could cost a fraction of the cost of rebuilding it and potentially serve as a downtown attraction. He said back in August it would bear less load, deteriorate less quickly, and provide a better amenity for the community for fewer dollars. But at-large council member Connie Bozer, now Des Moines mayor, responded that until the city has a better understanding of growth in the East Village, as well as traffic that the Market District development will attract, it would be premature to forego maintenance of that bridge for vehicular traffic. According to city data, an estimated total of 17,000 vehicles traverse the Grand, Locust, Court, and Walnut Street bridges each day. The capacity of each bridge is 12,500.
Well, this headline reads, Boeing 737 MAX is safe to fly, experts say, but I have to tell you it's accompanied by a picture of that Alaskan Airlines flight where there is a gaping hole that was left after a door plug was ripped off during the flight. So I hope that the story is more encouraging than the picture. In the wake of the latest Boeing 737 MAX fiasco, a weeks-long grounding following the explosive decompression of an Alaska Airlines flight in January, a lot of passengers are inverting that old mantra, if it ain't Boeing, I ain't going. Duke Vu, 41, was already wary of flying on the 737 MAX 8 after its second crash in 2019, but the most recent incident confirmed his feelings about the aircraft family. Boeing has pledged to be transparent and strengthen safety. But for me, it's a little too late, the Philadelphia management consultant told USA Today. Vu has tried to avoid the 737 MAX line when he flies, even switching his go-to carrier from Southwest Airlines to American due to the higher number in the former's fleet, though neither fly the MAX 9 variant involved in the January incident. In light of everything that happened with the Alaska flight, I felt very validated in my decision-making, he said. Vu is hardly alone. Social media is littered with posts from travelers who say they want to avoid Boeing 737 MAX jets in their future travels. Travel booking company Kayak even included filters on its flight search page that allows passengers to exclude itineraries with certain aircraft types. But for most travelers, it may be tough to decode what kind of plane is operating their flight because ultimately airlines, not passengers, are Boeing's customers. Travelers may not have much say over what kind of plane they're boarding once they've decided to fly somewhere. Most experts suggest there's no reason to worry, though. Many point to the excellent overall safety record of aviation in the U.S., and airlines that fly the MAX say they're sticking with Boeing, even as regulators increase oversight of the company's production lines. The Boeing 737 MAX's shadowed regulation is not random. Soon after the aircraft type entered service, two major crashes left 346 people dead. The line of planes was grounded for nearly 2 years as Boeing and regulators addressed a software issue that was ultimately implicated in both disasters. Once the planes were back in the air, there were no major safety concerns until January 5, when a door plug covering an unused emergency emergency exit ripped off during an Alaska Airlines flight. No one was injured, and the flight returned to Portland, Oregon safely. But the incident once again led regulators to ground some Boeing 737 MAX jets. This time, only MAX 9 variants with the same door plug. 171 aircraft in all, until the cause of the issue was identified. The grounding lasted about 3 weeks, and many affected MAX jets are already back in service after undergoing required inspections. The National Transportation Safety Board issued a preliminary report on Tuesday suggesting that 4 bolts meant to hold the door plug in place on the Alaska Airlines jet were missing at the time of the January incident, though the agency said the investigation remains ongoing. But even after the 2019 grounding, which resulted from much more catastrophic issues, passengers kept flying matched aircraft when they returned to service. There's no evidence whatsoever that people were deterred from flying, Richard Abulafia, an aviation analyst and managing director at Aerodynamic Advisory, previously told USA Today. At the end of the day, airlines are keeping the faith, he said. While National Transportation Safety Board has not yet issued its final report on the Alaska Airlines incident, the lifting of the grounding suggests that regulators are satisfied that the door plug was the primary cause of the problem and that the required inspections are enough to rectify any future issues with MAX 9s. Casey McCreary, a Portland-based body piercer, had anxiety about whether Boeing planes were safe in the wake of the incident. But she said those fears will not dictate whether she flies or which airline she chooses. It does feel like it would be impractical to avoid them, but also them having so many planes out there that have not had these issues does help a little bit, she said. Both Alaska Airlines and United Airlines, the main operators of the MAX 9 in the U.S., said their inspections turned up similar manufacturing defects in other planes affected by the grounding. And the Federal Aviation Administration has stepped up oversight of Boeing's production processes in the wake of the incident. However, in public statements, regulators insist the MAX 9 remains extremely safe. Our findings during inspections of those aircraft showed that the quality systems issues at Boeing were unacceptable and required further scrutiny, FAA Administrator Mike Whitaker said in a congressional hearing Tuesday. We will follow the data and take appropriate and necessary action. The safety of the flying public will continue to inform our decision-making. Airlines are certainly frustrated by Boeing's manufacturing issues, but they seem satisfied that the planes they're ordering are safe. They're going through a rough patch right now, but I believe that Boeing is, across the board, from top to bottom, is committed to changing and fixing it, United Airlines CEO Scott Kirby said during the airline's January earnings call. There's no one that's a bigger supporter that wants Boeing to succeed outside of Boeing than me, and I'll do everything I can to help, Kirby said. Alaska Airlines, which operates an all-Boeing fleet for mainline aircraft, was similarly bullish on the manufacturer in its January earnings call.
And back to the main section of the Des Moines Register on page 2A, multiple states report new cases of measles. Most are happening in unvaccinated people. This is from USA Today. As cold and flu season drags on, multiple states across the U.S. are now also reporting cases of measles, a highly contagious virus that primarily affects children. This preventable illness was once common, but it was eradicated in the U.S. because of widespread use of vaccinations, which most recent cases do originate outside the country and happening to unvaccinated people. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention issued an emergency warning on January 25th, telling the public to remain vigilant after 23 cases were confirmed in several different states between December 1st and January 23rd. The case count do remain low, but reports of new infections have continued to pop up in many states across the U.S., some directly linked to international travelers. CDC data on current measles cases is updated monthly. In a January 25th update, jurisdictions in Georgia, Missouri, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania have all reported a total of 9 confirmed cases. However, several state health departments have also shared information about those cases, although some states have only reported 1 confirmed case at this time. The last major outbreak of measles in the U.S. happened in 2019, when a total of 1,249 measles cases and 22 measles outbreaks were reported in the U.S. between January 1st and October 1st. According to the CDC, this was the second highest number of reported outbreaks since measles was declared eliminated in the U.S. in the year 2000, and the highest in a single year since 1992. Many of these cases come from an outbreak in New York City. Of the cases, 1,107, or 89%, were in patients who were unvaccinated or had unknown vaccination status. Children received the MMR vaccine as part of their regular course of shots between ages of 12 months until 15 months for the first dose and age 4 to 6 for the second dose. The vaccine protects against measles, mumps, and rubella, and it is 97% effective at preventing measles when both doses are given. Now, according to the CDC, measles symptoms appear 7 to 14 days after contact with the virus and typically include high fever, cough, runny nose, and watery eyes. Measles rashes appear 3 to 5 days after the first symptoms. Other signs and symptoms of measles include high fever, cough, runny nose and sneezing, red watery eyes, loss of appetite, diarrhea, a reddish-brown rash that can spread across the body, and tiny white spots that may appear inside the mouth 2 to 3 days after the symptoms begin.
Nikki Haley says Trump is to blame for recent GOP setbacks. Republican presidential candidate Nikki Haley pointed the finger at her competitor, former President Donald Trump, when talking about a string of GOP setbacks last week. Republicans had a really bad day, Haley told a crowd in Newberry, South Carolina, on Saturday afternoon. The reality is chaos follows him, she added, referring to Trump. On that day of all these losses, he had his fingerprints all over it. House Republicans suffered back-to-back blows Tuesday as their long-awaited vote to impeach Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas failed with the help of a handful of their own members, along with the GOP's bill to fund aid to Israel. That same day, a federal appeals panel ruled that Trump is not immune from charges alleging he tried to overturn the 2020 election. The judges rejected arguments by Trump's legal team that a president could not be prosecuted unless impeached and convicted by Congress. What is happening? Haley asked before placing blame with the former president. We can't be a country in disarray and a world on fire and go through 4 more years of chaos, Haley said. We won't survive it, she added. Haley included in her list of Republican losses rumors of Republican National Committee Chairwoman Rona McDaniel's post-South Carolina primary exit in the wake of tension between Trump and McDaniels. South Carolinians will head to the polls for the GOP primary election on February 24. Haley, South Carolina's former governor, had events planned throughout her home state over the weekend ahead of the start of early voting on Monday. Haley also took aim at President Joe Biden on Saturday in her speech in Newberry. Biden had his own rough day Thursday after a special counsel report described the president as what it called a sympathetic, well-meaning elderly man with poor memory. That's the end of the quote from that report. The White House fired back at the report, with Biden's attorney criticizing what they called highly prejudicial language. He can fight it all he wants, said Haley, who has called for mental competency tests for politicians throughout her presidential campaign. Do you have something short for us, Nicole?
No.